Hello and welcome to episode 22 of the Thundercast. This is our second Industry Insights podcast, where we focus in on recent happenings in the video game industry. I'm Matthew Sorry, and joining me today I have Shane Ryan. Hello. Okay, Shane, so our first topic of conversation is second-hand games and the future of being able to use second-hand games. So we're hearing a lot of rumours about Microsoft and Sony's approaches to used games on their next-gen consoles. There's lots of confusion being going around regarding specifically the Xbox One with regards to used games. Phil Harrison's comments when being interviewed by Wired didn't really clear things up.
Nope.
But apparently I've read recently that you can still buy used games from shops, but shops have to pay some kind of license fee to the developers maybe, or the publishers.
Yep.
It's still kind of not clear. Hopefully we'll get clarification at E3, but what do you think about the potential of not being able to buy used games for your next-gen console? Well, you'll be able to buy them, but you'll have to pay maybe to be able to use them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't fully understand. The used game industry is a weird one anyway. I guess it's really regional, so we can only really speak from being in the UK what it's like. But if you walk into a store and there's a brand new game out, secondhand, it's probably £3 cheaper. And then you buy it, take it home, and in the past you'd have to pay some sort of pass, or you don't get some sort of extra character or something, like, you know, Borderlands, where if you bought it brand new you got a download code. So really there's a lot of talk about how, you know, secondhand sales and certain stores, it's pro-consumer, but the truth is that from that angle it's not, because as a consumer you're getting ripped off, really. You're a few pounds cheaper, but at most point you're going to end up spending more. And it's a weird thing, but I think that the anti-consumer part comes from the choice, basically, and who owns what is where the issue comes from. But what I want people to kind of think about a bit more as well is it's not if when someone sells a store secondhand, like we have Game in the UK, that doesn't make them pro-consumer. They don't do it because it's better to the consumer. They do it because they make a higher profit on selling secondhand games, which is why when you go into a store, if you have the top 10 shelves, you will have second-hand copies of the game next to brand new copies. And to people walking in, they probably don't even know the difference.
It's a better deal for those companies to sell you the second-hand game. They buy it off you. Like, I don't exactly know what the percentages are between the disparity between the price that they will sell a used game for and the amount that they will pay you for a used game. But if you've ever traded in, I've traded in, and you know that it's a ridiculous margin that they're making, sometimes double, maybe even more. What they pay you that they're making on that used game. So I think it's quite strange. What we've heard recently is that the shop, so GameStation, wherever you're going to buy your game from, will have to pay some kind of license fee to kind of reactivate the used game. And that seems to be hurting them instead of hurting the consumer, which is good from our perspective, but obviously this is a big part of the store's business.
Yes.
So do you think it will really negatively affect the relationship between, say, Microsoft, Sony, and GameStation, or any of the big stores?
I think a lot of the game stores have their back against the wall anyway. Last year, the year before, there's a lot of closures, buyouts. Everything's going more digital all the time. I mean, you had Game and GameStation where they destroyed a load of old retro games and consoles and just completely, they actually just destroyed them. So they've completely lost. And then it's always talk about pro-consumer. And I understand why people talk about pro-consumer, because, you know, they're thinking Microsoft and Xbox and maybe Sony and PlayStation will dictate whether I own some or not, and that's fine. But the walls and the conversation are getting blurred, and it's all getting a bit messed. It's not just a simple case of use games, yes or no. There's a lot going on as to, and I think from a published point of view, if they will think, they'll walk into a store and they might see their new game out, and 90% of the copies are secondhand, and they're thinking, well, I'm not going to get anything of this.
Yeah.
Now that isn't anti or pro consumer. That's a totally different point. And I think what's happened is there's a bit of an argument going on between companies that are kind of using it as almost, I suppose, in a simplified way, a tax loop, where they found a way where they can buy and resell a product at a better profit margin to themselves. But the downfall side of that is that the companies get, apparently less sales. Now, people might say that it doesn't affect sales, but when you go into a store, and the price of the game is pretty much the same, but a few pounds cheaper, of course people are going to buy the cheaper one. But because this is an industry so controlled by PR and everything else, we will never know how much money these companies actually make off secondhand sales, and we'll never really, we'll always struggle to understand how much money actually goes back in, because most people that trade games in are probably going to buy brand new games. It's just, it's so hard to tell what's going on. Now, however, I do believe it would be anti-consumer for them, for a company to tell you you don't own something, unless it's already been dictated. So
yeah.
I recently had a look at the back of the 360 boxes, and it doesn't say anything about resale or lending. Now, on DVDs, a lot of DVDs, it does make some mention to you cannot lend or you cannot resale this product. Or on CDs. So that's already covered there. But on games, it doesn't. So at the moment, when you buy something, you're not in a contract where they can say, well, you should know that we're only lending the digital rights on this disc to you. So unless the new consoles, the boxes on the back, it states, not, you know, you do not have permission to lend, resale, public performance, then they can say, all right, well, we've actually stated it in the small print, which again is a bit sneaky.
It is, yeah. I mean, there's two kind of perspective of the publisher who's making this content. They see this content go out there into the wide world, and they see the sale of that content, and they're not getting a cut of it. So you can understand where they're coming from. It makes sense that they would want to get in on that sale there. But you can also see it from the perspective of the consumer. It helps the consumer out. You can buy more games. So like you said before, you might be putting more money back into the industry than you would have. So there's also that argument. There's lots of different arguments there. And it also kind of feeds into the issue of DRM, because what we're hearing from Microsoft is that you will buy a game and you will install it onto your console, and by doing that, you can take the disc out, you can play it without the disc. You when you buy the disc, you're essentially buying a license to play the game. So that's where the whole idea of the shop having to pay for another license to reactivate the game and sell it as a used game comes in. So talking about DRM, that kind of brings us on to our second topic of conversation for the podcast, which is the Twitter campaign, hashtag PS4NoDRM, that's been happening recently. So this is a lot of people, a lot of gaming interested people that have been having this Twitter campaign to try and stop the PS4 from having DRM, because obviously there's been lots of issues with DRM recently, if you think about SimCity and Diablo and things like that. So were you involved in this campaign, Shane? Did you tweet the hashtag PS4NoDRM?
No.
Okay, neither did I.
No. I think I'm too cynical and jaded. I'll just think, how many people have tweeted it compared to like 70 million console sales, a small amount. And you also have the thing where if I was working for Sony, this would be brilliant. Because all I have to do is go on Twitter or make some sort of public statement that say, we love our fans, they're passionate. And it's like patting a dog on the head. You know, the fans wag their tail. Like, yeah, Sony, love us, they're listening. It's like, well, they've already made the decision. And also, do they really care about 0.00001%? And they probably think, if you've listened to what Sony's sort of attitude has been in the past, they're probably thinking behind closed doors, they're going to buy it anyway. They're not going to buy one. These people are locked into gaming. They play games all day, every day, as if they're going to turn around and suddenly change their lifestyle and not buy a console. All we've got to do is do less than what Microsoft is doing.
There you
go. And we're on to a winner.
We've got to at least like appear less bad than Microsoft.
Yes.
And then we'll sell more. There you go.
But Sony does that by shutting up, which is what they did really well when they got asked the question at their conference. When someone asked them and they just said, we won't block them. And then when they got pushed, they were like, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah,
it's
worth pointing out that none of these issues, DRM, used games, none of these have been clarified by these two companies.
Nope.
I mean, if you read Phil Harrison's interview with Wired, it's just so unclear. It makes no sense. I can't follow his train of thought when he's talking about how used games are going to work on the Xbox.
I think he's trying to be really convoluted to try and not say something rather than just saying we've not decided.
Yeah, it's that whole politicians kind of thing where you say a lot. Lots of words come out, but there's no substance to back them up. They're phrased in a very clever way so that you don't have to back them up.
I think it's good that people are actually doing something in this case. There's more to it when we get to the political side of the risks of people thinking that saying stuff on the internet somehow makes changes. There's a lot of perceived belief that there's freedoms that the internet grants, which isn't true. And there's a certain thing where if people post stuff online, somehow it makes some big difference. But people forget that things quickly change, you know, the whole Aliens Colonial Marines thing, and people saying, I'm never going to pre-order a game ever again, happened about 3 months ago, and everyone's off pre-ordering games straight away. No one's got any integrity. People say, I'm never going to play Call of Duty, and the next year, after doing campaigns online, you know, there's pictures of them playing online and stuff. So it's, I'm glad that people are doing it and getting behind something, because if the risk, it's a weird thing, because the risk here is, if the, both these companies do this and go down the DRM route, it's never going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
They'll never go back, ever. But Steam already does it. And yes. People love Steam. I think Valve's absolutely pro-consumer brilliance.
But Steam in itself is a digital distribution service. Well, you have to have the internet connection.
Both of these consoles by their end will be digital only.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the case. And I think we will see this come to fruition. I think it will end up being the case, because I think you're right. I think by the end of the life cycle of these consoles, there will be digital distribution services. Mm-hmm. I think hard disk sales are going to slowly fade out over the lifespan of these consoles.
Yep, if they start doing as well that you can buy it the day before and install it and get it ready for, and it has a countdown clock, kind of what Steam has, then people would easily do that rather than going out. You get people that still like to queue up because they like the social element, but for Steam, I mean, if you look at that, it's just how that's grown so quickly. I mean, you're still... cases are good for people that like to go out and buy stuff, for impulse buying. Well, Steam's great for that, but you need to be logged in. And also for people to buy gifts and presents, because, you know, you don't get a PC game as a gift anymore, because I guess you just ask for money to
put credit on your account. Credit on your Steam account, why not? Buy what you want.
But I definitely think both consoles will be a big digital platform push, or there better be.
Oh, yeah. No, there will be, definitely, but those consoles can't abandon the disc-based market at the moment, obviously, because that is still a huge proportion of their sales on the consoles.
Mm-hmm.
That's still how a lot of people get their video games.
Sure.
But, with regards to DRM, would it bother you if Sony's console, as well as Microsoft console, had some kind of DRM integration feature?
It's one of those things where it doesn't affect me yet, but when it does, I'll understand. I think DRM is one of those things where, the same as digital stores, you know, with people that have got their accounts blocked and banned on Steam or Origin or for whatever reason, and they can never access those games again. When you think about stuff like that, that's concerning. And that's the problem with the digital platform, because if you did something, or you got accidentally blocked, or something went wrong, or there's some weird terms and conditions that you breached, you know, you're just one person in millions, no one's going to pay attention to you. There's people that have been blocked and banned. I mean, people that have posted on like EA Orange forums that have had their access blocked, and therefore lost
everything. It is a weird kind of pervasive control that publishers and developers and whoever's platform you're using, they do have that weird kind of control, and it just, I don't know, it feels almost a bit Orwellian the way that Xbox One's going with the Kinect camera being able to watch you and sense you at all times and be able to tell everything from like your heartbeat and your emotions.
Technology
supposedly
just moves so fast.
Yeah.
I mean, it was only like 12 years ago that mobile phones were coming out. It's gone absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, and all you had then was Snake.
If that.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. We'll see if the PS4 nor DRM Twitter campaign actually causes Sony to change their mind if they are going for DRM. Or
the thing is, Sony can play it either way, because they either just go quiet and this will die out, or they'll say, oh, you know, We're going to do what the fans want. We've done this, even if it's their choice. Now, if they've already decided they weren't going to block it or do some DRM sort of thing, then they can just ride this out and come out as heroes at the end. And it's absolute, from a business perspective, this is a dream.
Yeah.
Because either way, they're not going to look as bad as Microsoft, because all that Microsoft's going to do is say, yeah, we're going to do it. And a month from launch or something, Sony will say, yeah, we've got to do it, because, you know, publishers and people are like, oh, those bloody publishers. We still love you, Sony, not buying an Xbox.
It's not you. It's not you, Mark, Sony. Yeah. Oh, God, he's so cool.
But so it's weird how... it's always that underdog thing, isn't it? For some reason, people see the Xbox and Microsoft as a threat and Sony as the saviours, but they are both massive corporations who only want your money, and they are not your best friend.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of get the feeling that both of these console manufacturers, they're both holding back, maybe, on revealing what their plans for
definitely.
This kind of software is. They both want to see. They don't want to show their cards too early. They want to see what the other players' cards are, so that they can counteract that.
That's why I've got so much fluff so far. Yeah. So when you look back on both like presentations, overall the Sony one came across best. But when you look back at the services they talked about and being able to jump into people's games and take control, there's not been even a hint of a mention of that since. And I really wouldn't be surprised if it's like, yeah, we'll do that in 3-4 years.
Yeah. I mean, I think update. E3 is going to be interesting this year because that's the stage where they have to reveal all of this stuff.
Yep.
They've had their initial cloudy, kind of vague, ambiguous discussion of what these consoles can do. But it'll be interesting to see on the stage E3 if they actually do give some hard facts and figures and talk about functionality and then demonstrate it.
It's the last big platform before they're both going to get launched. And if it's almost that thing where if neither of them say anything about used games, they can talk about games all day, but the internet will explode by the end of the day in rage if neither of them confirm anything about used games. Which is that they can all day they can do exclusives and stuff, but everyone's just gonna be sitting there thinking, yeah, but used games. That's what everyone wants to report on now. It seems like that's selling a console more than the games.
Yeah. Well, I think within the community of people who are very, very interested in video games, yeah, that will be the talking point. I think to the general wider community, they maybe don't even, or they maybe won't even consider this when they go out to buy their next
Absolutely
console.
Not.
Yeah, it won't it's even like, be a factor that they think about, maybe.
Mm-hmm. People that go and on internet forums and stuff, it's like they're a small percentage of, there's not, you know, it's like,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
The amount of consoles out there to people that actually go online and talk about this, and I mean, with the amount of Xbox pre-orders rocketing already just because of the Call of Duty trailers and stuff.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about PS4 and Xbox One and Microsoft and Sony, but something else that happened very recently, in fact, that happened alongside the Microsoft Xbox One reveal, was a spike in Wii U console sales. What percentage increase was this spike share?
Well, it depends how you read it, you see, because it's the sales rank. So they went up ranking 875%.
Yeah.
On Amazon UK.
870. That's ranking. Okay, so I guess that's kind of weighed against the other things that are selling on Amazon.
Yeah, so there were I think there were 390 in the hardware listing and they shot up to 40 or something. But then somebody went in to see what that actually meant. So obviously loads of people are dead happy. You know, the way you sell it is showing that people just want a video games console. Again, that's all hyperbole. It's not the case whatsoever. And when you actually look at what's happened, top selling consoles, number one at that point was Microsoft 360 with Kinect. So that's the number one selling console at that time. So clearly that is what people want, and that's a media center. Then the 3DS, PlayStation 3. Then you get down to number 16, PlayStation Vita. 17, PlayStation 2. 18, Wii U Basic. 19, DSi White, 20, 19, PlayStation Jesus. 2 Slim, and then 21, Wii U. So the PlayStation 2 on Amazon UK is currently outselling the Wii U at that time.
And that's just UK?
Yep.
My God.
So there's this big story. Obviously, everyone just saw that for 85... Oh, right, it's exploded. Those people, you know, are voting against it. Well, it's... No. The reality is it paints quite a disturbing picture of the fact they're being outsold by two generations ago, the machine, and they need to with this Nintendo Direct, they really need to come out and wow everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty dire picture at the moment for Wii U. It's obviously not selling very good, and even with a huge increase in sales, huge percentage increase, they're still not selling very well compared to maybe some of the other consoles at the moment. So I think it's not looking very good for the Wii U. I think you're right. I think E3 needs to be something special for Nintendo to draw attention again. And to be honest, I think if they just show another Mario game and get a Mario advert on TV, that will cause in itself a sales spike.
Yeah.
Or maybe Mario Kart as well, because Mario Kart sold a ridiculous... If you look at Mario Kart Wii, that sold ridiculous numbers. I think it's up in the 30 million.
Isn't that one of the best-selling games of all time?
It is, yeah.
The thing about Nintendo is if you go into the best-selling games of all time, I'm sure 9 of the 10 games are Nintendo ones.
A Nintendo, and most of them are probably Mario games. I have seen that list before. So, Mario...
I'm sure Mario Kart sold more than Call of Duty. Something insane. Modern Warfare 2.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
It's just because it sells continuously over time rather than dipping out, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, it does. And it has such a wide audience. lots of people enjoy Mario Kart. But it's quite interesting that this sales spike, this particular sales spike, happened directly alongside the Xbox One reveal.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously people have been watching the Xbox One, listen to this news, and I find it hard in my head to believe that people watched this initial unveiling and thought, screw that, I'm not going to buy an Xbox One, I'm going to go mm-hmm. get me a Wii U for all the great games on that console. Can you understand the mentality? I don't understand why the Xbox One reveal conference would cause you to buy a Wii U. I know there weren't many games shown, but it's just the initial reveal conference.
Yeah.
I mean, do you really think there's a section of people who are waiting with their money, thinking about their next console they're going to buy, thinking maybe I'll save it for an Xbox One, but no, now I've seen the Xbox One looks rubbish, I'm going to get a Wii U?
I think some people just thought, I just bought one anyway. Or maybe just talk of consoles.
That's what
I
think.
Kind of like subtle subversive psychology of the more people talk about consoles, the more people just want a console.
That's probably the scenario. Well, that's the scenario that makes the most sense in my head for why this sales spike would have occurred.
So, on a slight tangent, I've just got the games database. It's off VGCharts.com. So, it's, you know, people think it's not always 100% accurate for whatever reason, but it's a good way to look at it at least. So if we're looking at the top 10, Wii Sports, 81 million. I know it came with boxes, but it's a lot. Super Mario Bros. On the NES was 40. Mario Kart Wii sold 33 million globally. Wii Sports Resort, 31. Pokemon Red, Green, Blue, 31. Tetris, 30. New Super Mario Bros., 29. Wii Play, 28. Duck Hunt, 28. New Super Mario Bros. Wii, 26 million. That's first
Duck
party.
Duck Hunt, 28. Oh, my God.
Yep. Nintendogs at 11, 24. Pokemon Gold, Silver, 23 million. Wii Fit, 22 million. Mario Kart DS, 22 million. Wii Fit Plus, 21 million. And then at number 16, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas at 20 million. That's the first non-Nintendo title. And then after that, it just goes back into Nintendo. Yeah.
And then I imagine there's a little first Call of Duty games. Section somewhere a bit lower down.
Somewhere in the cut. Yeah, Modern Warfare 3, 14.
Hmm.
So Mario Kart and the Wii sold twice as much as Modern Warfare 3.
Well, a bit more.
That was just the Xbox, actually. So that you add them up.
I mean, people. Well, the community that we exist in, like on Thunderbolt, and the people that we talk to day in day out, think of Nintendo as kind of this, I don't know, wounded animal lagging behind. Oh, it's not doing very well. They're not doing very well. And yes, the Wii U isn't doing very well at the moment. But
everyone
all
buys
you need to do is flash
party.
A Mario Kart game, and then hey presto, there you go.
So if you add it together, the Wii Kart. Mario Kart Wii play sold the same as like the Modern Warfare games and stuff.
Yeah.
But probably a bit less overall, but that's over three platforms. This is on one. So they've done pretty well. And again, that's just the amount of profit they'll make off those first party titles. That's the sort of thing that can save them. But what?
Well, I really don't think Nintendo needs saving. The company has been in profit since the early 80s. They've never made a loss until the Wii U came along.
I don't mean save them as in, you know, it's game over, that's it, one console is dead, but I mean just in the case of this coming back to, because the GameCube is one of my favourite consoles, I have a massive soft spot for that, and that was pretty much seen as the same.
Mm.
There's hardly anything on it, but when something came out, it was absolutely fantastic. Like, Metroid
it was an event.
Good.
Yeah. And to be honest, like the lack of information and knowledge that we have at the moment about what's coming down the line, say this Christmas period for Nintendo, actually gets me quite excited for their E3 about what they're going to show. I mean, we know about Pikmin.
Are they not doing that direct instead of E3?
Yeah. They're not going to do their conventional E3 press conference. They're going to do a series of Nintendo Directs, and then they are going to have a booth at the show where people can get hands-on. I think they're also getting lots of hands-on booths for different games that are going to talk about the show in various GameStops around America. I believe I read that somewhere, which is quite an interesting way to do it. I think that's quite an interesting way to spread the word, not just localize E3, where it's this kind of like really focused games media. Kind of spread the word, and you'll get other media interested then.
What's interesting, actually, is the amount of advertising about the console has died. He has a huge wave of it, and now it's just stopped. Mm. And I wonder if it's because they're reanalyzing how do we actually market this to people without people just thinking it's an add-on for a console.
I think that's so confusing. I think they can't really ignore. I mean, Nintendo generally seems to ignore the kind of like mass consensus general opinion and just goes and does their own thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work out okay for them. But with the Wii U not doing so well, I think they can't really ignore how people have been talking about it or actually how people haven't been talking about it because they don't understand what it is. They don't understand that it's not just an add-on for the Wii.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be quite interesting to see what Nintendo shows at E3 and whether that can cause a similar spike in the sales of Wii U's. So that's it for our first section of this Industry Insights podcast. We'll be back with another three topics in a second. Okay, Shane, so topic number four on this podcast is the release of Mojang's next game, Scrolls. So obviously Mojang are the developers of Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
Scrolls looks absolutely nothing like Minecraft to me. It's a turn-based, card-based as well, strategy game from mm-hmm. the looks of it. Are you interested in Scrolls?
I'm interested to see what the developer does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a card-based game, and I used to, many years ago, in my teenage years, play Magic the Gathering.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been the first even rule set, early days of playing that. So I used to play a lot of that. So there is a slight, and I've always been tempted by the, I used to have a friend that worked in the company at the time, and they were making them, the digital ones, the download ones of Magic the Gathering, the actual games you can get on the Xbox and PC.
Yeah.
It's always been very tempting for me. But I've never actually got round to it. So this looks like it's doing something similar to that. It reminds me, was it a Magic game that came out where you had like the two armies facing each other? And it's like
I think it was.
It looks a bit like that, but with cards to actually play down. So I'm definitely wanting to try it out. So the beta will be out by the time this is up. But there does seem to be, I have seen talk about some form of microtransactions in it. So it isn't free to play, but I've also seen the term microtransaction knocking about because there's a trading system where you can trade cards.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can buy cards or you buy decks with random cards or you win cards. There's a whole, I guess that's the world they're really going to build that system on, I reckon.
Yeah, it looks like there's going to be some kind of online marketplace where you can trade, and maybe that's where that will come into it. Some kind of store system, which will be quite interesting. I think it's interesting that we're seeing this from Mojang. This is the next game, obviously following on from Minecraft. And anyone who knows anything about games, or maybe even not, will have heard of Minecraft because it was a phenomenon. It was a huge thing, and obviously it made Notch and the guys at Mojang a lot of money.
Lego for adults.
Well, there you go, and for kids as well.
Mm-hmm. As is Lego.
For everyone. Yeah, true. So, I think it's quite interesting that they're doing something completely different. I mean, this is something that that's can't really be compared to Minecraft in any way. Like, Minecraft you can play for hours and hours and days, and it's about creating things. Scroll seems like it's a game based around very rigid structures and about how you play within those structures. So it'll be interesting to see whether it's a success or not, and whether they can capture some of that magic that they had with Minecraft with a very different type of game. Do you think you'll be checking it out tomorrow, Shane?
I might do. I think I'll definitely next week, because what I expect is the same sort of philosophy to how they built it, which is really simple.
Mm-hmm.
Minimal menu screens.
Yeah.
And it just lets you get on with it, but it's really addictive and it's really deep. Mm-hmm. So the entry, like the bar to entry is really low, so anyone can just jump into it, which is what I kind of expect.
So very accessible.
Yes, but then the more you get into it, the more depth, and it just keeps on going and going and going. Mm. And I think that trading system is what they will see as a big way of locking people in if people get certain cards. I mean, you can imagine if they started doing like foil versions of cards and stuff like that, like you used to get when you buy stickers.
Yeah.
Just even little systems
like
that.
Maybe you can scan your cards that you buy with the Kinect or something. AIG style.
Buy actual cards and scan them in. Like that thing you used to get when you scan barcodes, yeah.
Mm.
I can't remember what that's called now.
Amazing. So Scrolls, that's coming out tomorrow, so that'll be out by the time the podcast is up. Let us know what you think if you played the game. So point number five, The Last of Us has just announced that, or Naughty Dog has just announced, should I say, that if you pre-order the season pass for The Last of Us, you will get access to new story content. So this is single-player content. This isn't multiplayer add-ons like map packs that we normally see as downloadable content through season passes. So what do you think, Shane, about the creation of story content as downloadable content instead of actually having it in the game? Do you think this is a bad thing, a good thing? I think it's quite interesting, and we'll get into this now, to talk about how maybe this could affect the way that they create the single player story that you're going to buy. Definitely. When you just pick up the game.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
From a perspective of somebody that as like a customer or a viewer or the audience, whatever you want to call it, I always find it strange. With video games, people are called customers, but if you watch films, you're the audience or the viewer. So I always find it quite interesting that video games, it's the transaction of money that's the vocal point for kind of the audience. Quite strange how it's come about. But with The Last of Us, with the pre-order, basically when you get the season pass pre-order, and they've said that some of it is going to be story content and some of it multiplayer. Mm-hmm. So the story content instantly suggests that decision has already been made. And it also means that they've got to leave the ending open in a way to add on. And it just feels
that's kind of assuming that it's going to chronologically follow on from the narrative that you play in the main game. Or
it's cut content?
Yeah, it could potentially be cut content, yeah.
From the main story?
I think
story.
It'll be quite interesting to see how BioShock Infinite's DLC plays out. Because that is single-player story content that kind of takes place alongside the narrative in the original BioShock Infinite game.
And they've been very quiet about that.
They have, yeah.
Yeah, so I can imagine.
So I think it's quite interesting that we're starting to, because typically DLC has been map packs and add-ons for multiplayer, where that kind of makes sense. But we are now starting to see single-player DLC that maybe could have potentially been added in as part of the story when you first got the game.
Oh, absolutely.
And maybe the developers cut it out and said, yeah, we'll take that section, we'll sell that as DLC, it's a profit deal, it's about the money. That makes sense from their perspective. From the consumer's perspective, you're getting less of the game than you maybe would have got 10 years ago before DLC was an option for
them. I think it shows that the companies, and this isn't to do with the developers themselves, because this would be the publisher and shareholders and everyone, and just the general practices, is now that they've realised that they can take the piss and no one's going to do a thing about it.
Yes.
So now you have pre-order content, you have discounts, you have day one DLC. In the past, I think it was a Ubisoft that just came out and said, yep, we cut content from Assassin's Creed 2 or something, it's day one DLC. And everyone went, oh, bloody hell, and everyone went out and bought it anyway and just proved them
Assassin's
right.
Assassin's Creed 2 was just, it was blatant what they'd done, because there was a section in the game where, like, it was actually physically in the game world where you should have been able to go somewhere and you couldn't go somewhere. And it was quite obvious that there should have been a mission there, and they were holding it back and you had to buy that as DLC.
Yep, and no one cared. No one made a stink about that or demanded anything or even wrote, you know, the big gaming websites, there wasn't really a push there or a refusal to refuse, you know, a refusal to review the game because they'd decided, oh, actually, this isn't right. So I think it's good to point out, and it's a bit upsetting because it's not even out yet and they're already saying, oh yeah, there's extra content that we're going to take money. You're buying something that doesn't even exist. So, and I do find the pre-order season passes disgusting. When a game isn't out and they know that they can get money off people. Now, the people always say, oh, well, you know, I'm saving money over time. Yeah, but so many, the percentage of people that probably don't actually get time to play all that content that gets released, you're not actually saving any money. It's like when you go into a supermarket and buy one, get one free. They're just half the price or double the price of one of them. You know, so when you're buying it, it's still the same price. You know, they're not, this idea that companies are giving you something for free. No, it's all worked out. They know exactly what they're doing. And people just shouldn't buy pre-order stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case. We shouldn't buy it. As consumers, if you don't want these practices to continue, you shouldn't buy it. But the truth is that you can't control everyone, so there will be a certain subset of people who do buy it, and therefore it makes it financially viable. It makes financial sense for these companies to chop a bit of the single-player campaign off and sell it as DLC down the line.
You could say exactly the same thing about the Xbox One, where everyone said, you know, oh, this is a disaster, media content, it's a mess, but I guarantee you it will sell loads because they know what they're aiming for. It's the wider market, which is where the industry is at now. pitching for those.
But specifically with The Last of Us and the effect on single-player games, I don't want to see a situation where we are seeing where you play single-player games and you can tell that content has been cut, like it did, like I could in Assassin's Creed 2. You can tell where sections have been cut out purely so the developer can sell them down the line and make more money from their game.
Yep.
That's kind of hurting the art, if you will. It's yep. not you're not getting the full experience that the developer intended you to have because of a profit deal.
And we will never know about this sort of thing that happens behind the doors, and I guarantee it happens all the time. Mm. So if people say, no, it wasn't cut, it's like, well, yeah.
You'll never know.
No. Nope.
You're right. We will never know this kind of thing because these are closed-door decisions that publishers and developers make.
But it's got to affect the game because it's got to affect the story, again, at the end. Because let's just say, again, we don't know anything, but let's say at the end, everyone dies. How can you have DLC content?
You're playing as ghosts.
It's just, unless it happens before, but then why are you going to care? Which happened with another game we'll talk about, but
that's not always the case. I think if a developer has some ideas that maybe they can't execute on in time, or they don't have the budget for to begin with,
DLC, and that
is there's a place for DLC, and I think there is almost a place for single player DLC. I mean,
yeah, definitely.
I'm thinking about Dishonored and the Knife of Dunwall DLC that I played recently, which is a really cool piece of DLC. You're playing as a different character, and you're playing a story that happens parallel to the story that you played in Dishonored.
Yep. The Last of Us, if you're another survivor, who maybe you meet at a crossroads and they walk off and you get to play his or her arc.
There you go. Maybe you get to play as one of the Mushroom Men, and you get to see the hardships of life as a Mushroom Man.
Or somebody that's becoming one of them.
Yeah,
finally.
There you go.
So there's plenty of good ideas, but again, don't buy it before it's even been announced. You're buying something that doesn't exist. It just makes no sense.
Which brings us on to our sixth topic of conversation, which is the huge UK pre-orders for Xbox One.
Yeah.
And also PS4 as well. I don't know if they were quite as huge, but online retailers in the UK have started listing pre-orders for Xbox One and PS4. Mm-hmm. These look like they're listed at £599 to begin with the caveat that when the actual and probably inevitably lower prices are announced, that their pre-order costs will drop.
Yeah, they were there
in line with the announced cost.
Yeah, they were the Amazon ones. So the pre-orders on certain other websites, more independent ones, are currently listed at £399. But that's because with Amazon they have it's the conditions of their pre-order, so they always put it higher.
Yeah.
To cover themselves.
Yeah, just in case.
Yeah, I think it's the cost you pre-order at, you always get at that price, so they've put it up there just in case. But basically, the stories that come out was that within a week of the announcement, or something like that, the Xbox One had more pre-orders than the PS4 had since its announcement back in February. Mm-hmm. Which, when you consider the time frame, you know, that's quite an impressive spike. And it just goes to show that it clearly that all that marketing clearly worked to some degree.
Yeah,
you know, getting Call of Duty.
Microsoft. Yeah.
Yep. Call of Duty adverts on TV and stuff now, it comes up at the end, it just says Xbox One, and that's it. Makes no other mention of any other console.
Yeah, that works wonders for console sales.
Yep.
So it's interesting that Xbox One is outselling PS4 at the moment in terms of pre-orders. I think you're right. It's probably Call of Duty. I think that's probably the sole factor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe also the fact that Xbox One's press conference reached a slightly wider audience than maybe PS4s did with all their talks of sport and TV and things like that.
They've been advertising big on it already.
Yeah, yeah.
I've not seen any PS4 adverts in the UK at all.
Yeah. No, I haven't either. No, I've seen quite a few Xbox One adverts. Well, no, actually, Call of Duty Ghost adverts now.
So really, we don't see Xbox adverts, but we'll see Call of Duty and then Xbox One at the end. And that shows how big that franchise is to the industry now.
Yeah.
If you can... Essentially, if they release a console... And off the back of that, which is going to be a multi-platform cross-gen title, it just shows how first of all, how much marketing does work and advertising, and that just by only having Xbox One at the end of a game like that, that's going to be across all these other consoles, the amount of people that are going to pre-order it. And I won't be surprised if they do the same with Madden and FIFA and just wrap it up.
Yeah, it would be interesting. Microsoft seems to have not control, but the greatest interest in those kind of massive, massive super franchises. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to pay off for them.
Yeah.
So I think also let's talk about the whole idea of pre-ordering a console before you know exactly how much it's going to cost. I mean, I don't know exactly what the rules of these pre-orders are. I assume it doesn't lock you in. I assume you can cancel
your
pre-order at some point.
Yeah, you're not charged until it ships.
Okay, so that's okay then. So if you can cancel before that, that's okay.
And this doesn't actually mean sales, so maybe come to launch, the Xbox One will sell 4, and the PS4 sells 4 million. It's not going to happen like that. It'll probably be pretty even. But it just shows, it's just a way of kind of, it's just interest. Because I've pre-ordered both. But it's just because it's basically a waiting list.
Yeah.
And I just know...
So you're just making sure.
Yeah, exactly. And closer to the time, I'll just cancel one or both, depending on how I feel. But I just know from, for example, when the Wii released over here, and there's a huge demand for it because the amount of marketing they'd done, and that's sold out, and you could only get it if you'd pre-ordered on the day in the UK.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I think it's quite interesting that pre-orders are such a huge thing now. Companies really use them to decide how many consoles they're going to get out to certain areas and things like that as indicators of where the interest lies. And I suppose they're good indicators, so that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there's always the rumours back when Nintendo with the Wii that they were holding back on some stock or not releasing it all the time to keep the sold-out, you know, must-have item.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of how it works as well, so...
Yeah, create the illusion of demand.
Yes.
So, that's it for this section. We're going to come back in a second with three other topics, and I'm just going to go off and pre-order my PS4 and Xbox One right now. See you in a second. Shane, so topic number 7, which is quite interesting to me considering that I've just pre-ordered my PS4, is that Sony is reportedly going to mandate Vita Play for all PS4 games, Vita Remote Play I should clarify, for all PS4 games that don't require the PlayStation Eye peripheral. So you'll be able to play your PS4 games on the move around your house, so yet another video game console that you can now play whilst you're on your toilet, which, as we're seeing, is the true next-geniness of these next-gen consoles.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the prospect of being able to play your PS4 games on the toilet, Shane?
Doesn't interest me at all.
No interest?
No.
Okay, interesting.
That's that done. Let's move on. No, there's not enough shoulder buttons, is there?
Yeah, that's what interested me. There isn't. There's only 2 shoulder buttons, I understand. I mean, I don't own a PS Vita. I've played them at expos and things. But yeah, I don't think there is. But they've got a back touchpad, don't they? Which could potentially be used as a surrogate shoulder button. We just have
is
to
this
going
to have loads of like adverts and trailers of people streaming Netflix while they're on the toilet through their
most likely
theatre thing?
Streaming it.
I don't. Why would you? I'm trying to think of a situation.
I'd be quite interested in this. I've got my PS4 console upstairs. I'm downstairs doing something. I'm in bed. Maybe I want to play a quick 10 minutes of the game that I was just playing
sleep.
Upstairs.
You're activating your brain too much. So no wonder you roll around and wake up feeling knackered in the morning. Read a book.
There you go.
Sleep better. better dreams.
That is the truth of it. I generally try and keep gaming out of the bedroom because it's not too healthy. So kids, listen to your parents when they say you should switch off your game console and read a book instead before you go to bed.
Exactly. You end up with ADHD. Pack
there
it in.
You go.
I think it's good that they're doing it because it's for them. Because again, it's they're trying to make the Vita something that's worthwhile purchasing, and that's quite a big thing they can kind of sell. And I know there's some people that with the Wii U, for example, that play it on just the gamepad thing.
I mean, I like that because I can be sat in the front room, and some of the people can be watching TV, and I could be playing something on the gamepad. I think that's quite cool. The 2-screen experience is something that lots of people having these days. It's a very common thing. We've all got iPhones, iPads, as well as TVs, as well as computers. So many screens at our house now.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Multi-screen functionality. Yeah, it is ridiculous. But for Sony to jump on the bandwagon, it makes sense. And it gives the Vita another lifeline that it really needs, ironically, considering its name. Because it's not doing amazingly well. And I think having that integration will incentivize sales.
I think what this could be for the bigger picture is for them to try and get into their streaming service, where when you've got Wi-Fi anywhere with your Vita, you can stream certain games from your profile that you've bought. So like indie games.
Yeah.
For example,
so
you could be sat at a cafe streaming it.
Yeah, let me get this straight in my head. So you would be playing them from the cloud, essentially.
Yeah.
But playing them on your Vita, because you can stream them over 3G or Wi-Fi or whatever you're using.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting.
So
yeah,
it's more a future plan, because again, if both Microsoft and Sony want these consoles to last another 8-year cycle, then this is the sort of thing they need to put into the contracts now to lock people in, so in 4 years when they release this, everything's already set up.
I mean, we've already heard Microsoft talking about how they intend to use cloud computing to increase the power of the Xbox One.
I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I don't really. Bandwidths are too slow at the moment, but it'd be interesting. Maybe 4 or 5 years down the line, it could make a difference.
Yep.
And we also know that Sony's got Gaikai, and they talked a little bit in their press conference about how they intend to use Gaikai possibly in the future to have some kind of backwards compatibility, but it would be through streaming, not necessarily through the discs that you own. So, yeah, I think you could be right. I think this could be the start of Sony's plan to get a streaming service going, and what better way than to stream your PS4 games, whether they're small indie games, to your PS Vita. I think that's a great use of the PS Vita, and that will really just regenerate interest in the Vita, because it doesn't have that
I think
much
some people would buy a Vita just to stream some of the library on the move, even
it
let
would,
alone no more
would,
games.
I've got to say, it would interest me. I mean, there's a few games on the Vita that I'm interested in, but I just can't justify the price of the console at the moment. But if I do end up getting the PS4 and there's lots of Vita integration there and I can do things like that, that's definitely something I would consider.
I think that's the angle they'll go for eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, so bravo Sony, fair play. If it turns out to be true, then that's very interesting. So topic number 8, Shane, which is on a completely different note, is something that's happening on Steam soon, which is the implementation of trading cards.
Yep.
So trading cards will be kind of like achievements. You earn them by playing the games in your Steam library, only certain games. So you will earn them the same way that you will earn achievements on your Xbox or trophies on your PS4. But these trading cards form some kind of metagame themselves, where you can trade them with people, you can battle them, you can get shiny versions of them. It kind of sounds like Pokemon trading cards I used to do when I was a kid. What do you think of this, Shane? Are you going to become obsessive on Steam, buy thousands of games just to get trading cards?
No. The psychology behind this is incredibly dangerous. And again, it comes back to the thing of people saying Valve are great. And to be fair, Steam is great, but this is a dodgy turn. This is, to me, almost as creepy as the Kinect always being on. Because I mean, the Kinect always being on, you can visualise that. I'm being watched, don't like it. Whereas this, it's so subversive and subtle. Mm. You're locking people into some sort of gamification of being on a PC. Like, everything you'll do will somehow lead to something that you can sell or trade.
It's yet another way of gaming exploiting obsessive compulsive disorder to make
it's money. Always funny when you get that thing of, oh, you know, Valve and stuff, it's like a communist thing. It bloody isn't. It's not the most capitalist thing I'm going.
It truly is.
But this is so basically it's in beta at the moment. I'm on it, but I've not got any of the games. So there's only a couple of, there's like Borderlands 2, and then the bunch Don't Starve, and then the rest are like Valve games.
Yeah,
and as you play them, you get these cards. I think you can even get foil ones that are worth more, which I think is quite funny. And then you basically build them up to make badges, and you can craft badges, and then you can level up your badges with experience by doing other things. And then you can sell and trade stuff. And then when you get to certain points, you'll unlock things like backgrounds that you can then either use or before you use them, sell and trade. And then you can get temporary discounts for games. But again, that's just compulsion of buying games, because you weren't going to buy the game anyway, but now you go and buy it because it's 50% off, but you still spend money.
Dear God, you just know that you're going to read those Kotaku articles in the future about the guy who spent his life savings buying games on Steam just so he could earn all of these
trading trying to get
cards.
A gold shiny card, because there's only five
trying
of them.
Trying to get a shiny Charizard.
So it's happening. It's on its way.
It's happening.
And then there's talk of Microsoft as well, how they've painted achievements for adverts as well, haven't they? Which is a similar sort of thing where...
Yeah, you get achievements just for watching TV because, you know, we humans, we need even more positive reinforcements for doing fuck all.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations, you're sat in the arse to doing nothing. Well done. Here's 5 game points that mean fuck all.
Here's a panda card. Go and battle it with your friends raccoon card.
So the next generation is going to have loads of this.
Yeah, I can see Sony and Microsoft jumping on this.
Yep. Smile. Advert, if you smile during an advert, you get 10 gaming points.
Oh god! If you watch TV naked, that's
have
a
you?
Thousand.
Did you ever watch?
Connect and
Tell. No, it was the Charlie Brooker thing. He did Black Mirror.
Black Mirror. Yeah.
The episode where it's set in the future and everything's gamified and people have to do fitness and they get gamer points and gamer points. You can buy food. That is
you
so
essentially
depressing.
You have to live on these bikes all your life, generating electricity so that you can earn enough points to compete in something where you could potentially injure yourself. I can't remember too well. So you could actually earn your freedom in the future.
It turns into some kind of like X Factor thing. It's one of the most depressing things I've ever watched, and it really is pretty much just an exaggeration of all of this now.
Yeah. I mean, it's not too... too unbelievable, to be honest with you. As we view things like this, as we see the way that companies are going, gamification of everything, and just instant gratification for doing absolutely nothing.
Yep. So lots more of that, and foil trading cards.
Yeah, and there you go. We'll all feel great about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Okay, so Steam trading cards. I might join you on that, Shane, and we can have some trading card battles.
Yeah, see what happens. I don't think you can... If you could battle them... That'll be a game in itself. Maybe there'll be
is
like
it just
a meta
trading system.
Yeah, maybe there'll be a meta game at some point. Mm.
Interesting. On a completely different note, E3 is just over a week away now,
mm-hmm.
and we here at Thunderbolt Games will have 2 people at the show on the floor covering it. We'll have the site's creator, Philip Morton, as well as a staff writer, Nick Rassar. Keep tuned to thunderboltgames.com to check out all of our E3 coverage. We're also going to have another Thundercast pre-E3 to talk about all of our predictions. And obviously, by that time, I imagine we'll have lots of leaks and things. So we'll have lots to discuss, lots to talk about. So Shane, what are you most excited about for E3 2013?
I don't know. The more I think about it, there's been so much talk.
Are you excited?
Yes. I think I'll be close to the time. Because this feels like the E3.
Yeah.
There's always talk about whether E3 is relevant anymore as companies do more of their own reveals and stuff. But this is, with Sony and Microsoft, essentially, this is their last big stage platform to say why you should buy their new console. And when you think that... I can't even remember the last generation where the consoles released on the same year, let alone possibly in the same month. They could both release in November.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the console wars, in inverted commas, this is probably the first time, to my mind, that they're going to go head-to-head, and it'll be quite interesting to see the sales figures come Christmas, because obviously you will have lots of internet commenters claiming that one company has won, the other company
already
hasn't. There you go, has won the arms race is the console war.
Especially if one of them slips out and misses the European window for Christmas and there's only one console that'll just sweep up that year. But for E3, I'm actually interested to see what happens on the indie side.
Yeah.
Because there's all this talk about the big platforms, but it's usually when the really interesting small games start to appear and get a bigger platform. So I know that Phil will be tracking down as much indie stuff as he can, and we'll hope to have some interviews with developers.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely looking forward to that side.
I mean, I've got to say the same thing as well. We're probably very interested in indie games because, I don't know, I would guess that they're the games at the moment that most interest you to play.
Easily, yeah.
Yeah, because generally they are the most interesting games. They're not just the repetitive, homogenous, same every year. They have the new ideas and the fresh ideas, and that's where you get something new. So, yes, very excited to see what indie games we get at E3, but still interested in what the big console manufacturers have got to say. Check out our Thundercast 23, which will be the E3 preview Thundercast next weekend. Okay, Shane, so that's it for episode 22. If you want to let us know what you think of all of these industry insight topics, head on over to thunderboltgames.com and check out the forums, or alternatively, contact us on Twitter @_thunderbolt or email us at podcast@thunderboltgames.com. From me, it's goodbye, and from Shane,
goodbye.